Welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink and food in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning in this week to the NOLA Drinks Show, friends. As always, I certainly appreciate it. Hey, wanted to mention a few things. We got a good show coming up for you here today. Of course, as I always like to say, I always think it's a good show. But we have Jim Clark, who is the U.S.-based representative from Wines of South Africa, joining us. We taped this show very recently over at Cane and Table right before a special industry wine tasting on South African wines took place. So thanks to Cane and Table for hosting that. And it's a lot of fun. So Jim usually comes on the show about once a year, every time he's here. And it's kind of connected to something that's going on the second annual South African Wine Week, which is going to be happening November 7th through the 13th at various establishments around town. What Jim usually does, he's been doing this coming down, doing an industry thing for the past handful of years. This is the second annual South African Wine Week, open to the public, of course. And what Jim does is he will come down and do an industry tasting to showcase some South African wines for some of the venues that are participating or might be interested in participating and hosting an event. Gives everybody an opportunity to taste and maybe select some wines and some things like that. But Jim joins us on the show, as he has done for the past couple years or so. And it's an interesting chat. We chat about the South African wine industry, one of my favorite places. There's great stuff going on there. It's really fun to kind of get these snapshots like we get during this tasting I just mentioned, or South African Wine Week, where you can partake in that, because every year it just seems to get better. And it's a sort of palpable growth that's just, you know, an improvement in quality that you can really sense each time. A lot of better wines that, you know, weren't necessarily available in the States or exported much around the world are becoming more available. Just lots of really good stuff going on. There's also sort of a youth movement as far as winemakers and wineries go in the South African wine industry. Some really interesting stuff there. As a matter of fact, this was a sort of coincidental. Jim and I taped this upcoming portion of the show that you're about to hear before the wine tasting. And one of the wines that we tasted, it's going to be in the segment after this next one, we focus on Chenin Blanc, which is sort of a calling card varietal, if you will, of South African wines. Very famous white wine grape, very often associated, of course, with Loire in France. And it's really kind of forming the backbone of a lot of wines, kind of literally, in the sense that a lot of white blends are using Chenin Blanc as their base. But there's a lot of single varietal Chenin Blancs with some really interesting expressions out there. But Jim and I, so we use this particular segment to focus on that particular grape. And we happen to taste one of the wines that we just sort of, I don't want to say he picked it, but the wine in particular was a Chenin Blanc from a winery called Lubanzi. And one of the co-owners of Lubanzi, two young American guys, actually started the winery over there in South Africa. And his name is Walker, and I'm apologizing, I'm forgetting Walker's last name, nice young man. But we happened to taste his Chenin Blanc. So it was great because I got to meet him later on at the wine tasting. Very passionate, very enthusiastic young man. I'll bring this to your attention as well, talking about that particular segment, because if you're interested, if you're listening on the radio here this evening on a Monday in New Orleans or catching the podcast, we did an IGTV segment, also Instagram TV. Okay, if you're not familiar, it's a little Instagram newfangled thing they got going on where you can do some slightly longer format videos, and we actually videotaped that particular segment talking about Chenin Blanc and tasting this particular expression of Chenin Blanc. So if you want to go check that out, you can head over to our Instagram account. If you're listening on the radio, it'll be there tomorrow. If you're hearing it on the podcast, it's there now. And there's actually a link in our show notes on our website at noladrinks.com. But you can go check us out at noladrinks on Instagram and see what you want to see there. So there you go. You can watch me and Jim drink Chenin Blanc. Good times. Now, it's actually pretty interesting stuff. So go check that out. I wanted to mention also, again, getting back to South African Wine Week coming up, as I said, November 7th through the 13th. Week-long stuff going on at some different places where you can get some specials on the buy the glass stuff, on bottles, happy hour things. Some people are doing some featured food pairings, like suggested menus that are going to go great, say, with a flight of wines, that sort of thing. And then there's some singular focused events that are also happening. One I want to flag to your attention, if you really want to learn about South African wines in a really good format, on Saturday, November 10th at Brennan's, where we actually taped a show not too long ago with their wine director, Braith Tidwell, as well as their executive chef, Slade Rushing. And we talked quite a bit about South African wines there. But they're at Brennan's at 417 Royal Street. They're doing that Saturday from 3 to 5 p.m. November 10th, just to be clear. They're doing a comparative wine tasting with South African wines, obviously. And these wines are being tasted alongside similar wines from around around the world, which I think is a great way to improve your palate, explore these wines. Maybe you kind of have a favorite style, something domestic or something from the old world that you really like. And Jim and Braith are going to be there kind of showing you some similar things and some different things as they compare to South African wine. So I think it's really cool. It's a great way to not only explore the wines from South Africa, but also improve your palate. And you know, if you listen to this show regularly, I'm a big fan of comparative tasting, that you're tasting things, say, side by side, maybe trying a same bottle of wine from a particular winery, but you're just tasting, excuse me, a different vintage, for example. So maybe going from one year to the next, or tasting a wine from, say, two wineries that are neighboring each other and tasting the same varietal and same vintage to do that kind of comparative tasting thing. And I really think it helps you articulate your wines better. I really think it helps you understand wines better. It develops your palate, all kinds of really cool things. And so this is a great way to do that. Saturday, November 10th at Brennan's, 3 to 5 p.m. You can call them at 504-525-9711. Get more information on the cost. Make yourself a reservation. But a lot of really fun stuff that's going to be going on. Also, some of the week-long stuff where you can just kind of pop in and enjoy some glasses. Our good friends there, Bar Francis Uptown on Ferret Street, is going to be doing some doing a featured flight, I think a featured red and a featured white flight, and have the BTG by the glass. That's how we say it in the industry specials. Rosedale and Mondo, the Spicer joints, are going to be doing some stuff. Mo Bar, part of LeBlanc Smith Restaurant Group. Maypop and Mofo, Michael Galata's spots, are going to be doing some cool stuff. Whole bunch of things going on. So if you are interested, and we touch on this coming up here in the segments with Jim, but you can go to sawineweeknola.com. Again, sawineweeknola.com for more information. Also, Jim will stick around and he's going to join us for another Shot with Nola Drinks, where we talk a little bit more about the industry, taste some red wine, and then I'll be back with my parting shot at the very end talking about something. So friends, we're going to take a little break here on the Nola Drink Show, and then we'll be right back with Jim Clark from Wines of South Africa. Come on back.
Well, after I'm through this bottle of wine.
Brian Diaz here with the Nola Drink Show. Hey, the second annual South African Wine Week returns to New Orleans from November 7th through the 13th. Explore this fascinating wine region, one of my favorites, that produces truly excellent wines all at a great value. Some of your favorite bars, restaurants, and bottle shops around the metro area will host dinners, happy hours, special tastings, and more. Join the conversation online using the hashtag SAWineWeek. To get more information and see event listings, visit sawineweeknola.com. Cheers, y'all. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening in today, as always, this week. And pleased to be joined by my friend Jim Clark, who is the U.S.-based representative for Wines of South Africa. From now on, with that, Jim, we'll call it WOSA. And
perfect.
Because we're so busy, we got to work through with an acronym here. And it's great to see you, man. How you been?
Very good. Glad to be back in New Orleans.
Yeah, it's great. This is sort of like the annual trek. So we sort of do the annual show with you. I'm starting to count on this. Right about this time of year, you come on the show and we talk South African wine.
Absolutely. I think it's a good time of year to do it.
I think it's a really good time of year to do it. And we'll hit on this again in a second, Jim. But you are here. We're actually here taping this. You're hearing this a little bit later on. But coming up in November, starting November 7th, we have South African Wine Week taking place here in New Orleans. And it's kind of taken an exciting turn these past couple years with it.
Yeah, so we're back again, and we've learned to avoid Halloween so that we don't lose people to their costumes and their hangovers. So we're doing it the 7th through the 13th this year, and I think we've got Veterans Day weekend, so there's a little bit extra time to get out on the weekend and enjoy some South African wine as well.
Yeah, and like I said, we'll talk a little bit further about this towards the end of the show, the radio portion anyway. But just so people know now, the idea is that there's all kinds of different venues across the city and even outside the city are going to be doing, they kind of do their own thing, right? Might do a flight, might do a happy hour, might do a paired dinner.
Exactly. I mean, some of them are shops, some of them are restaurants, some of them are wine bars. And the idea is that they just put the magnifying lens onto South African wine for the week in whatever way makes most sense for what they do. So this year, a lot of places are choosing to do kind of a by the glass feature where you can go in and try a couple wines or a flight, perhaps paired with a signature menu item or something like that. But everyone kind of does their own thing with it. As long as it's South African, we don't mind.
Yeah, there you go. South African wine. So if you're out there listening, you know, go check it out. It's going to be a lot of fun. We'll tell you more where you can find information about it towards the end of the show. But Jim, let's talk a little bit about South Africa and the wine region and the story in general. I know we've touched on this in shows past, but it's a really fascinating story. I think a lot of people maybe aren't familiar with the wines, but the winemaking industry there dates back centuries, actually.
Yeah, actually. So coming up in, well, January, February, because that's when harvest is over there. But in 2019, that'll be their 360th harvest.
Oh, wow.
So, because we actually know the birthday. It was Groundhog Day, February 2nd, 1659, when the guy who was kind of in charge of what is now Cape Town wrote in his diary, "Today, praise be to God, wine was made for the first time from Cape grapes."
Yeah, right. Okay.
So we have a birthday.
Yeah, that's really cool because, I mean, most places don't know that. So that's pretty neat that you can actually mark that date in your calendar and then celebrate. Is anything going on to kind of denote the date and celebrate it, or just acknowledge
it? We're kind of talking about it. Still trying to wrap up this year before we plan next year. But okay. We definitely there was a lot of attention to the 350th year. But, you know, I guess once you're talking centuries, just being a round number in the tens isn't as important as being a 50 or 100. So
right.
It's an anniversary, but it's not. We've had a lot of them now.
Right, exactly. And we're figuring by the time we get to 400, probably, you know, most of us aren't going to be here anyway.
Right. So I hope to celebrate that one. But
I hope you're
right,
here.
Let's get it in now. Good idea.
Well, so and we've talked about this on shows past. So let's talk a little bit more about the industry there today, Jim, because we've seen a lot of advancement. One of the things that we talked about, and I'll give the date where people can go listen to the show last time you're on, where we kind of delved into the history a little further. But, you know, we had apartheid had a great deal of effect on this, where it was sort of an isolated industry for various and obvious reasons. But these days, the world has opened up to South Africa and to South African wines, hasn't it?
Absolutely. And a lot of what's happened is there's been kind of three waves. I mean, as you said, South Africa was cut off for a while, for a couple decades or more, because of apartheid. They came into the market in the 90s, but when you've been cut off, you can kind of not keep up with what the rest of the world expects from wine. Maybe some trends and improvements in the wine industry, things like that, didn't reach South Africa as early as they should have because of that. So the 90s were a period of kind of relearning and adjusting to what the rest of the world was doing. I think in the early 2000s you saw some really good wines, but there wasn't a real identity to the wines yet in terms of being able to make them taste South African.
But people were just sort of trying to mimic style from elsewhere. Is that really largely
often,
why?
Yeah. So, okay. I mean, especially if you think of that era, I think everywhere in the world, we talked a lot about this international style, you know, big, rich reds, and it didn't matter where it came from. As long as it was a big, rich red, it would probably do well in the market. These days, I think people want wines to taste like where they come from. We want to, you know, I don't want to be geeky and say the terroir, but still, South African wine should taste South African and have something special to say instead of just becoming a high-priced commodity. And that's something starting around 2008, especially, you saw a lot of young producers starting new brands that kind of shook up the industry. And now even the big companies are on board trying to just let the wines speak for themselves and speak for what the South African soils and growing conditions give them.
Right. Now, I think it's really interesting. And one of the things I say to you every year that I see you is, it's really kind of fun to do this. And not that I don't drink South African wine in the interim, but there's always interesting things that you bring and the week sheds light on certain producers that I've not experienced before, and you kind of get them all, you know, in a chunk, if you will. And one of the things that's always really, really fun is it's actually very palpable to see the progress and the change and the improvement from year to year. I think it's a really neat snapshot, and it's actually really very real.
Absolutely. I usually go down to South Africa twice a year, and every time I go, I'm like, oh, I didn't know about this yet. This is interesting. This is new. This is exciting. And especially, I was there last month in September, and we have Cape Wine, which is a triennial convention we have. And that's where I really get a chance to taste very broadly in one setting, or at least see people in a very big setting. And Cape Wine 2015, who are all these producers I've never heard of? And now here they are, they're in the U.S. market and they're doing well. I'm sure that's going to happen now with some of the people I saw back in 2018. This year.
This year, right. Yeah. So, and a lot of younger winemakers making the move into the industry there, right?
Yeah, and not just with their own brands. I mean, it's really exciting to talk about these guys, but if they're making 3,000 cases, let's face it, if, you know, 400 of those cases make it to the U.S., that's pretty exciting. It's going to be hard to find those wines. But now we're seeing those young guys are being given the freedom within the bigger companies. Maybe it's a family-owned company. Maybe, you know, it's just a bigger company that's hiring people and realizing the talent pool they have and taking advantage of it. So there were even larger producers down there that I had kind of maybe not, I wouldn't say dismissed, but maybe they weren't kind of showing as well as they could, and now they've got real talent on board that's really letting the wine speak much more clearly.
Got it. Yeah. Let me ask this, because it actually makes me pops into my head when you say this. We talked a little bit about the effects of apartheid. So part of the reality of this was that there was not an exchange of talent, knowledge, education. People were not able to go study abroad, and you didn't have people coming in to teach or influence, if you will. And in this case, are we finding that there are more educational opportunities within South Africa itself as far as programs in universities? Obviously, on-the-job training is going to be available in the wineries for people working.
Yeah, well, I mean, University of Stellenbosch has always been in the center of things for winemaking. And then just outside Stellenbosch, you have a school called the Elsenburg Agricultural School, which does kind of the viticultural side. That's always been a very strong program, but now that exchange, that ability to go and work harvests all around the world and see how they do things in the Rhone or how they do things in Australia or California or wherever it might be, and bringing back that knowledge and not bringing it back, like we discussed maybe before, about a decade ago, where we bring it back so we could imitate it. It was bring it back so you could use those tools better in the South African context.
Got it. Yeah, that's really cool. It's very exciting. And we're sort of, as we've talked about before, it's sort of growing up before our eyes here in a lot of ways. And I think it's a really, in a geek way, like we were talking about, it's such a unique circumstance that as a fan and a person in the wine industry, it's really interesting to watch.
Absolutely. And it really is it's important to remember, it's a rebirth. It isn't, they've been making wine for centuries and it's been kind of meh and no one's really noticed, and now they're making quality wine. I mean, in 1800, one of the most popular wines in the world was Constantia. It was a mm-hmm. South African wine. Mm-hmm. So it really is reclaiming a heritage, not building a new one.
Well said. That's really important to note here, too. Let's talk a little bit, too, about we're starting to see more wines in the United States and elsewhere being exported from South Africa. And I think, as you said, we're starting to see more of an identity being driven through these wines. And I think one of the functions that I seem to see is that people have that sense of place. People know what they're supposed to grow in a particular location, as opposed to trying to force feed something into a location. Is that a fair way to say it?
Absolutely. Again, it's that that what goes best here rather than what does the market demand.
Right.
So I don't want to pick on Pinotage. It's a uniquely South African grape. It gets a lot of grief here in the U.S. But when... Just like, I'll pick on someone else. I'll pick on Pinot Grigio.
Okay.
If you think of Italian Pinot Grigio, the first ones, when it first became a thing, they were really good. Mm-hmm. And now everyone jumps on the bandwagon, and you have to really look to find those good Pinot Grigios.
A lot of flabby, a lot of
exactly.
boring.
Exactly, yeah. So when the industry really thought that Pinotage was going to be its calling card, there was a lot of pressure for people who maybe didn't have the best vineyards for Pinotage, for growing Pinotage, to plant Pinotage and take part in that drive. And that really was to the detriment of Pinotage.
Right.
And to the detriment of South Africa's reputation, really. Nowadays, we do see people starting to focus on Chenin, but it's much more nuanced, and it's much more, you know, no one's making Chenin because they have to. They're making it because they believe in it. And same with Pinotage these days, actually.
Yeah, and that's what we're going to do in the segment after we take a break here, is we're going to focus on Chenin a little bit. With Pinotage, a couple questions. So Pinotage is a cross between Pinot Noir and, what am I, Mauvais?
And Cinsault.
Cinsault, thank you.
Yeah,
right.
Which historically in South Africa was called Hermitage. So Pinot Noir plus Hermitage became Pinotage.
Yeah, got it. Yeah. Now, do you find, because I think we were talking about how there was sort of maybe a stigma with Pinotage, but a lot of that was probably really just in wine circles, right? Because a lot of people, I'm talking about in this country, because a lot of people right. weren't particularly exposed to it. So is there kind of an opportunity now to reintroduce people to that grape that didn't experience it before?
Absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say that back in the day, the poorer Pinotages that came into the market, that consumers didn't taste them and maybe they didn't like them. But to worry now that they remember having a bad Pinotage in 1998 and aren't going to enjoy the ones that are coming out today, or aren't willing to try the ones that come out today, is a little extreme.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about a whole new generation of winemakers, but even the ones who were drinking wine back then, I don't think they remember that experience. And I think today's wine drinker, whatever their age group, is interested in trying new things.
Right, that makes sense. And we've had some really lovely expressions in the last couple of years of Pinotage. Are we going to be seeing some people, do you think, embracing that grape during Wine Week and featuring it?
I would expect, if they're smart, because I definitely find when you tell a wine drinker, you know, maybe they haven't heard of Pinotage, hey, this is uniquely South African, it was developed in, you know, oh, well, that's the one I want to try.
Mm-hmm.
When I talk to the trade, they're like, oh, Pinotage, and maybe they, but... But then if they do taste it, they can realize the quality that's out there these days.
Great. Excellent. Well, Jim, let's do this. Let's take a little break here.
Okay.
And then we're going to come back, and we are going to talk about Chenin Blanc, which is also a calling card grape, I think is fair to say, in South Africa. We'll probably taste one or two expressions. And you can also go catch this on IGTV if you want to look at our handsome faces. We're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on back.
Black head of sun, Bobby Charles Cole Blue. Catholic church bells toll the Louisiana blues. Oyster rake scraping down Grand Isle Way.
The 12th annual Oak Street Po' Boy Fest is serving up a heaping portion of delicious food and music for one day only on Sunday, November 11, 2018. The Po' Boy Festival features 60 variations of the unique New Orleans sandwich from 30 local food vendors, plus performances from the George Porter Trio, New Orleans Suspects with Jennifer Hartswick, Morning 40 Federation, the Iceman Special, and more. General admission is free, and for more information, visit po'boyfest.com.
Goodbye, Joe. I got to go. Me oh my.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. It's the NOLA Drink Show, and Brian Diaz, I'm here with you this week, as always, and we're on WGSO here in New Orleans and a podcast land wherever you are, and we're also on IGTV for this segment, and I'm sitting here with Jim Clark, who is the U.S. representative for Wines of South Africa. Always a pleasure to see you, Jim.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. So we got some really cool stuff going on. We're actually here at our good friend's place, Cane and Table, a fine establishment here in the French Quarter, 1113 Decatur. And they're kind enough to host us. And we're actually, you folks are hearing this a little bit later on, but Jim, you're in town because we're doing a trade tasting here, wines, South African wines. And one of the really important South African wines, especially in recent years, that wineries have been embracing, winemakers have been embracing, and really the market has been embracing, is Chenin Blanc.
Absolutely. South Africa has always had a lot of Chenin Blanc for historical reasons, well, at least for much of the 20th century, and it's now really starting to become the signature grape for the whole country, really. And to put it in context, that there's more, well, South Africa has more Chenin Blanc than the rest of the world combined. So I think if you're used to learning about French wines first, as we often do for sommeliers and things like that, you think of the Loire Valley, but Loire Valley has less than half of the acreage that South Africa has.
That's really something to stop and think about there, yeah, about how important that grape is to South Africa.
Exactly.
In general. Yeah. And we're seeing, one of the things I think is really neat is because the wine industry geographically is so large in South Africa, we're seeing a huge amount of variation of expressions of Chenin, aren't we, in style, terroir.
Yeah, it's actually, I wouldn't say it's that necessarily large, because it's the total acreage in South Africa is just under 250,000 acres.
Okay.
And about 18% of that is Chenin. So even though it's the most important grape, the most planted grape, it doesn't dominate the way, say, Sauvignon Blanc does in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I think Chenin is a grape that can vary a lot with very small changes. Think of the Loire and think of Sauvignon, and a couple miles away you have Vouvray, and they're such different wines. So we do see a lot of different expressions within South Africa, depending on whether you're growing by the coast or more inland where it's warmer and all those sorts of variables.
And stylistically as well, people doing things, lees contact, a little bit of wood here and there, right?
Exactly,
and
yeah. Like you can also do a lot of different winemaking things with it. That's true, too.
And we're seeing that, aren't we, as far as... So people are not... I guess sort of my point here was that people are not making one particular style or approach to Chenin Blanc. There's a lot of varied approaches going on.
Yeah, and that's both a positive and a negative, though, because for the average wine drinker who wants to try out a South African wine, I don't want to pick on New Zealand, but I already mentioned them once. If you go buy a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc at $12, what have you, and you like it, I think if you go to another shop and find another one at that same price point, it's going to be stylistically similar enough that you'll also like it.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge with a South African Chenin is you could, at that price point, you could get one that's got a little bit of oak on it, it's kind of round and rich, and you could get another one that's very light and crisp and very, you know, kind of acid-driven. So both are good wines, both are quality, but stylistically, if you like one, you might not like the other. So that's been a challenge. What we're seeing, though, is kind of what I call the median style.
Okay.
And it's something I discovered when I was a sommelier. It's a fantastic tool for retailers or for sommeliers or just for people who have guests over. If the way I learned it was, so 50 people, a guest says, I'm going to have 50 people for a holiday dinner. Let's have one white and one red. And I said, well, your white's going to be a South African Chenin Blanc. And they would say, why? I said, well, what happens if you serve Chardonnay? And they said, well, people love Chardonnay. And I was like, does everybody?
Not everybody.
No. And he's like, oh, that's right. So-and-so hates, you know. And same thing with Sauvignon Blanc. They're tend to be kind of polarizing. But this median style of South African Chenin Blanc, you'll have enough body for the Chardonnay drinkers. So they'll put it in their mouth and be like, yeah, that feels like the weight of a wine like they're used to. I think for the priority for Sauvignon Blanc drinkers is that aroma. And these wines are aromatically generous the way a Sauvignon Blanc is. And then if you're maybe a Pinot Grigio drinker, to kind of find another type of white wine drinker, you're looking for freshness. Mm-hmm. And I think these wines still have that freshness. And so that's the meeting point. And I think that's where more and more people are going to be introduced to South African Chenin Blanc. And maybe if they lean toward the fuller bodied wines, they will seek those out as they get to know the category.
Yeah, and they can find that out there. Yeah. And I know one of the things I've said before, and you've probably heard me say this, Jim, is I'm a big fan of the 1 degree rule, meaning trying to get somebody, if you're very set in your ways, trying to get somebody to go stylistically too many degrees away from a particular favorite wine and approach. And similarly on price point, to try and get somebody to go, if they always buy a $15 California style Chardonnay, getting them to go to an $80 bottle of Barolo is quite an extreme jump in both prices.
Exactly.
And presentation. Yep. And so I think with Chenin, to your point, which is excellent, is that Chenin can really work with a lot of people, and white wine drinkers in general can find something that they're going to like in a lot of South African Chenins.
Yeah, definitely.
Is there something that we can kind of, and I know it does vary and I know it's a tough question, is there something we can kind of hang our hat on though, as far as maybe some commonalities among most of the Chenins there out of South Africa?
I think generally you're going to have some of the things I mentioned, you're going to have that freshness. Depending on where it comes from, for example, to my palate, I often find the Stellenbosch wines lean a little bit more toward fruit expression. And then we have a region called Swartland, which is north of there, that tends to be a bit more mineral. But there are always degrees of that. There's always a balance. What we have in our glass right here is actually a Swartland wine, which is this region that was a little bit off the radar. There had been grapes there historically for a long time, but no one was paying much attention till really a little over 10 years ago. A couple young winemakers started making wine up there and realized the quality of a lot of these old vine vineyards in particular, where they produce fewer grapes but better, because old vines just tend to naturally do that, and started taking advantage of that. So
this is, I kind of jumped the gun there. I was getting thirsty talking about Chenin. So I had a sip.
I appreciate your enthusiasm.
And, you know, one of the things, Jim, that jumps out at me about this one right out of the gate, if you are a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc fan, this wine is going to work great for you, I think.
Okay. Yeah.
And I mean, because I get a little bit, you know, there's the nice acidity there. It's it's bold in a very nice way.
Yeah.
And I get a little bit of the, you know, there's sort of the pepper note. There's a little bit of that raciness that, and it's not as extreme as some New Zealand Sauvignon Blancs. But the point is, there's something you can grapple onto.
Exactly.
You will.
I think you stick your nose in your glass and it's giving you something. You know, it's not as assertive as a New Zealand wine. And then to go back to what I was saying, I think it has a nice palate weight, which sometimes Sauvignon Blanc doesn't have. So if you're more of a Chardonnay drinker, when you get this in your mouth, you'll be like, yeah, I've got wine in my mouth. You know, this is the feeling I like and the texture I like.
Exactly. I was actually just going to say that, because the mid palate on this has some nice weight. There's a touch of creaminess on this. Do we know? So bit of lease contact probably on this guy?
I would imagine. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So no oak. This is all done with stainless steel. This is a very interesting project. It's started by two American guys, actually, who were students over there. They met over there and they fell in love with the country and came back and said, we want to start a South African wine brand. And they got connected with kind of a new face in the industry, which is Trezan Barnard, really kind of up-and-coming young winemaker down there, and then Bruce Jack, who's really one of our established gurus. And between the two of them, that knowledge base and that access to really great vineyards, they were able to put together a really really great set of wines. They make this, and they make the Chenin Blanc, and they make a red blend as well.
It's fantastic. And if we're talking about Creole Cajun cuisine, for example, as we often do here in New Orleans, got the acidity to stand up to a little bit of spice. The thing that I think is really interesting too, as I taste this, is when we talk about some of the Creole preparations of seafood, this is going to go really, really well with that.
Yeah. I think it can match the spice, and also the palate weight means it can match some of the richer dishes too.
Exactly.
So, matching, and I mean, you can always match by trying to cut through, but sometimes it's fun to match by equaling in weight or kind of balancing the weight. So, and I think that palate texture can do that.
Yeah, absolutely. This was going to go great with any number of shellfish things. You know, I know we're kind of being cliche here a little bit, but again, this would be, I mean, you know, I could just do, a dozen on the half
yep,
shell and just
go.
Be just fine with this wine.
You'll be happy.
Right here. We don't really need to get more complex than we, you know, than we need to be. So we are, Jim, seeing more and more Shannons on the market in the United States, and more is being exported around the world. Do we think that trend's going to continue? You said it's 18% of what's planted in South Africa. And is that kind of pretty static as far as...
Yeah, it's been pretty steady more or less for the past decade or so. I don't think that's going to change dramatically. I think... because I think right now we've reached the places where you can plant Chenin and make and do a really good job with it are established, and same with the other grapes that are planted. I could be wrong. I definitely feel like attention-wise, this was very interesting at Cape Wine in September. The feedback I got from a lot of the American guests who were there is that they were very excited about the whites in general. Be it Chenin or be it Chardonnay or white blends and things like that. The reds they were also very excited about, but it was the whites that was like they thought that's going to be the face of South Africa going forward. So
got it.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, Jim, we're going to do this. We're going to stop this segment. We're going to take a little break here on the radio and the podcast and sign off from IGTV. Want to give special thanks to our friends at Cane and Table for letting us do this here today. And Jim, good to see you as always. We're going to continue the conversation on the audio portion of things and. We're going to drink some more Chenin Blanc, friends. So we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show and sign off from IGTV. Come on back. Brian Diaz here with the NOLA Drink Show. Hey, the second annual South African Wine Week returns to New Orleans from November 7th through the 13th. Explore this fascinating wine region, one of my favorites, that produces truly excellent wines all at a great value. Some of your favorite bars, restaurants, and bottle shops around the metro area will host dinners, happy hours, special tastings, and more. Join the conversation online using the hashtag SAWineWeek. To get more information and see event listings, visit SAWineWeekNOLA.com. Cheers, y'all.
Well, my bucket's got a hole in it. My bucket's got a hole in it. My bucket's got a hole in it. I can't buy no beer. Well, I'm standing on a corner with the bucket in my hand. I'm just looking for a woman that ain't got no man. My bucket's got a hole in it. Yeah, my bucket's got a hole in it. My bucket's got a hole in it. I can't buy no beer. Yes, I went up on a mine.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here at the WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. We are talking South African wines, South African Wine Week, which we'll get to in just a second, chatting with Jim Clark, who is here from Wines of South Africa, or WOSA, as I like to say. As everyone likes to say, I didn't make that up myself. And Jim is the U.S.-based representative here. And we were just tasting some Chenin Blanc, Jim, and this is a really lovely expression. One of the things that you just mentioned, too, people being very excited about the white wines coming out of South Africa. And I think one of the things you mentioned too, South African, a lot of wines are wineries, I should say, are known for their blends, really, right?
And more than other New World countries, when we think of California, we tend to think of Cabernet, Chardonnay, Single Pinot Noir,
varietal,
you think of New Zealand, you think of, so it is varietal wines. Mm-hmm. South Africa has always been been comfortable releasing blends, and that's good in the U.S. market these days because we're finding the American consumer is receptive to blends, at least on the red side. Mm-hmm. White blends still can be a little bit confusing to people. The white wine drinker in America seems to be a little bit more focused on the variety, but I think they'll catch on because some of the blends are really exciting.
Yeah, there's a lot. Go ahead.
So what's happening for a lot of them is they're using Chenin Blanc to provide the kind of freshness and spine to the wine, and then they layer on kind of other varieties you may not have heard of, like, you know, Grenache Blanc and Claret Blanche and things like that, these sort of Mediterranean white varieties that provide all sorts of body and texture to the wine, and then the freshness comes underneath from the Chenin.
Mm-hmm. And some of these expressions are really neat, and lots of times I think they're very they're bold in their exploratory nature, if you will, in that a lot of varietals, I mean, we're seeing some of these blends might have 6, 7, 8 varietals. Is that still kind of, I mean, a lot of wines that you tasted me on several years ago when you and I first met, remember there was one particular white blend, I might be mistaken, I think there might have been 9, maybe 9 or 11 varieties.
I mean,
varieties
there aren't that many that go that far, but certainly having 5 or 6 varieties is normal. I think that was probably the Bodenhurst white, and
and
that's when it's always a moving target. I feel like every time I ask him what's in there, there's a different percentages of different grapes, you know, for the same vintage. So maybe no one knows what's in there.
Okay, fair enough. So like you could have been lying about the 1% Peak Po that we were finding going on in there. And so are you, when people are doing some of the blends and are as we've seen South Africa rediscover, as you said, its identity, were people kind of mimicking more, like using varietals that, say, we would find in a Rhone blend, for example, and then now have branched to kind of using Chenin as the base, as you said, and maybe kind of mixing up the varietals that they use that are very South African in expression?
Yeah, on the white side, the blends tend to be kind of more experimental. On the red side, it's usually, you can say, this is basically a Bordeaux blend, this is basically a Rhone style blend. There is a category that was developed, I think, back in 2006 was the official kind of release party of a Cape blend, which is 30-70% Pinotage, which we were talking about earlier, blended with other red varieties. So that is kind of a thing in itself. It's a Cape blend is a semi-official designation. So.
Okay, got it. Well, let's talk too briefly about sparkling, because there's a lot of good sparkling production coming out of South Africa these
days. It was very interesting. This summer, I spoke at the Society of Wine Educators Conference, and I spoke about Swartland, which is a really exciting up-and-coming region, or I guess it's up-and-come now at this point. and then I had another seminar where I spoke about Method Cap Classique, which is South African traditional method sparkling wine. And I thought the big attendance would be for Swartland. We got twice as many people signed up for the Method Cap Classique.
Really?
So that was really gratifying to see that people are beginning to recognize South Africa for their sparkling wines.
Does the Method Cap Classique more or less follow a lot of the guidelines or the process for the champagne method?
Yeah, pretty much. The big difference is they do allow grapes outside what we think of as traditional champagne grapes.
Okay.
So you might find a Chenin-based sparkling wine that way or something like that. The other thing is the minimum time spent on the lees, the aging period, is only 12 months rather than 15 or higher. Now most producers do longer than that. And for that matter, most producers do use Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. So they stick the tradition.
With just those two, and they are sticking with that. So are we seeing more and more Chenin making its presence known in sparklings more and more these days?
There's a few. There are several that are doing very well in South Africa, but they aren't courting the export market very much, so for whatever reason. So.
I'd be very curious to try some of those, because I'm guessing we're going to get a very sort of fresh, bright take on sparkling wine with these wines, with the Chenin.
Yeah, it's much like the difference of a Cremant de Loire compared to a Champagne in that sense. So you can see that. I think what's first of all unique about South African sparkling wine is that they actually have a term for it that doesn't try to rip off Champagne. You know, it's much nicer to say Method Cap Classique than it is to say just sparkling wine. At the same time, you know, saying Method Champenoise when you're not in Champagne seems like trying to borrow someone's thunder. So
great. Absolutely. And it avoids any hassle with the EU and things like that. So it's also politically and economically expedient as well. Well, let's do this, Jim. We got about 4 or so minutes left before we're going to close out the radio portion of the show. South African Wine Week coming up November 7th through the 13th here in and around New Orleans and the greater New Orleans area. We talked a little bit about this, but so we're going to have a whole week-long set of activities where people can go. You can go do different things over different evenings or different days, and people are actually, in certain instances, able to just kind of go to an establishment at any time and check out South African wines.
Yeah, so places like Pearl Wine Company and Bacchanal and Brennan's are doing kind of set tastings, so we'll put all that information up on the website, which is sawineweeknola.com. And then a lot of other places, for example, Rosedale, Mondo, Maypop, Mofo, they are all doing kind of by-the-glass features that you can come see all the time. At the Pythian Market, doing the same thing, where they're going to have a wine by the glass, and they're actually going to pair that with their, I believe, a lobster arancini, which I'm looking forward to trying.
Oh, that sounds really good. Yeah. Okay, cool. And we have our friends, Bar Francis is also participating there uptown. I think they're going to do a featured flight, if I'm not mistaken, a red flight and a white flight. So lots of different ways that you can connect with it. South African Wine Week, NOLA.com is the website, and people are kind of defining more and more about the specifics of what they're going to do.
Exactly. So, I think we'll still have events. Keep checking back at the website, because I think we're going to keep adding things as we get more details, and I think people get more creative as the time gets closer.
So. Yeah, there you go. It's sort of out of sight, and they go, actually, this is coming up around the corner. I better actually put my menu together.
Yeah.
And there's another way that you can actually track this and follow this. There is here we are, friends, in 2018. There is a hashtag that we all need to know about as
That's right. The hashtag's just SA Wine Week. So SAWINEWEEK.
Yeah, and I think it's good, because then if you guys go and do this in other parts of the country, you know, you might kind of be able to discover what people in New Orleans did some months removed,
exactly,
or you can follow
yeah.
it year round now, I think is kind of the idea.
Yeah, and that is the idea. I mean, we've been very happy with how it's been doing here in New Orleans, so hopefully we will take this to some other cities in the future.
Yeah, that's great. So yeah. this is kind of, thank you for mentioning that, because this is kind of a pilot for you. I mean, you haven't done this kind of thing so much around the rest of the country.
No,
right?
We haven't, and I really thought of New Orleans kind of because of things we talked about last year, the kind of cultural connections, the way New Orleans is such a mix of cultures. I think South Africa, you know, South Africa's nickname is the Rainbow Nation. So we have that same sort of thing, same mix of different cultures coming together. I also think, going back to Chenin Blanc, I think it's a great pairing with the food.
Yep.
So it seems like a really natural place to start.
I think it makes a lot of sense. Yeah. It fits really well. We're glad to have you here. I really want to encourage people to explore South African wines. One thing real quick, Jim, we got about a minute and a half left before we got to close this part out. And we kind of alluded to this briefly, but a lot of really price-friendly wines coming out of South Africa, too.
Yeah. Well, a lot of that right now is the exchange rate. So in 2012, the exchange rate was basically 8 South African rand to the dollar, and now it's up to 14 or 15. So the wines just kind of it just creates value when the wines come across the water in that sense. And it's also historically, South African wine hasn't had a big presence here, so they're kind of at that, I want to say they're not coming in at an entry point because it's not coming in at the $8 or $10 point. Exciting is that point, that $12 to $20 range, which is where really interested wine drinkers who want to explore look.
Yep.
And it's great to look at South Africa because you're going to South Africa. Maybe it's something new for you, but at the same time, it's a Cabernet, it's a Pinot Noir, it's a Sauvignon Blanc, grapes you're familiar with. So you're taking one step, but you still have some sort of basis for comparison.
I like that. There's my one degree rule there we were talking about
exactly.
earlier. So Jim, tell people really quickly, where can we find out more about South African wines in general? Just the Wines of South Africa website.
Yeah, I definitely encourage our head office website, which is wosa.co.za. That's Zuid-Afrika in Afrikaans. It's a great resource. We have our own U.S. website, but I really think the head office website is fantastic.
There's all kinds of cool. There. Yeah, it's great resources. There's maps. There's all kinds of really interesting stuff you can check
out. Yeah,
you
can even take an online course on South African wine right then and there and test yourself.
See, there you go. And then go impress your friends or go impress at the bottle shop. Drop some knowledge. Yeah. Friends, we're going to do what we're going to do here is we're going to close out the radio portion of the show. Jim's going to stick around for another shot with Nola Drinks, our podcast only stuff. If you are listening on the radio, go to noladrinks.com or your favorite podcast platform. You can get that there. So friends, remember, be kind to one another. Use your turn signal. And until then, cheers, y'all. Thanks for sticking around for another shot with Nola Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you on our podcast only portion of the show. I hope you are enjoying our conversation with Jim Clark that we recorded over there at Cane and Table. And a shout out to those guys. Thanks again for letting us tape the show there. We're going to bounce right back over there and continue our conversation with Jim. Talk a little bit more about some of the wine regions in South Africa. Taste through a really nice expression of red wine that comes from that country. And a little bit more. And then I'll be back right after that with my parting shot. Here we go. All right, everybody, we're here at Cane and Table. It's another shot with Nola Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you, and we're chatting with Jim Clark from Wines of South Africa. As you know, Jim, it's a whirlwind trip for you, man. You got here this morning. And you are staying overnight this time, right?
Yeah.
But flying out tomorrow morning.
Yeah. Give myself at least one night, but I'll be here for a full week when South African Wine Week comes in November.
So. Yeah, that's cool. That'll be a lot of fun. Yeah. So are you going to do anything good tonight, man? Are you going to do
something? I'm going to see. I've been a little bit burning the candle on both ends, so we'll see. Got a couple appointments after our tasting, and then we'll take it from there.
Okay, gotcha. Fair enough. We're not going to hold you to this. Plus, everybody who's hearing this is hearing this afterwards, so you can't be stalked. So, you know, if you say where you're going to go, nobody's going to come stalk you.
Yeah, okay. That's a relief. So,
Jim, we're talking about some different things, and one of the topics that we touched on last year when you were on, but very briefly. We're seeing more Black South Africans, I think, get into the wine industry, more Black-owned operations. And is that trend continuing? Are we seeing more of that?
Yeah, it's continuing. It's slow, and for a number of reasons. I mean, it's a problem faced by all industries in South Africa, given the history of apartheid and things like that. And it's maybe a bit slower in the wine industry, partially because historically the Black population in South Africa wasn't participating in wine culture. They weren't drinking wine, they were drinking beer and brandy. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't that kind of passion for wine that would drive them into the industry just out of natural passion.
And just familiarity, right?
And familiarity, exactly. Yeah. And then at the same time, one of the things, and this is been a lot of talk in the industry in the past couple months, is a lot of the industry is, I mean, wine industry is always a very low margin industry, but a lot of the industry in South Africa is not profitable. So if you're a young, smart Black entrepreneur in South Africa, you're going to look elsewhere. You're going to look into agriculture or mining or design or some of these things where there is a lot of growth, or a lot of better margins, at least, let's say.
Right.
We are seeing some changes. There's definitely, there's a fantastic brand called Aslina from a winemaker named Ntsiki Biela. She's Zulu, and she did not drink a drop of wine growing up, but she was a chemistry whiz in university. And someone said, well, you know, if you're going to continue, there's a fantastic scholarship in the wine industry, you know, to study winemaking. Well, if they'll pay for me to study, I'll go do it. And she developed a fantastic palate, and she had a real talent for it, and worked for a couple different wineries, and now has her own wine out there, and it's top notch. And it's not a lot of the Black-owned brands in the past have really gone after a kind of a commodity approach to wine. They just kind of been buying wine and trying to make a label rather than make your own wine.
In the domestic market in particular?
Yeah, exactly. So this is really, you know, making premium wine, you know, world-class wine. So it's really exciting to see. And there's a couple others. We're also seeing, as you have a rising Black middle class in South Africa, wine has definitely become an aspirational beverage. Mm-hmm. You see this, New Orleans will relate to this. We have Cape Town Jazz Festival is a huge happening in March. And all the rising Black middle class from Joburg comes down for the weekend, and they come to drink wine and enjoy the jazz. And I think just like in Napa in the 1980s, you know, you're going to see these doctors and professionals that have made it and want to show they've made it by owning a winery. And that's, you know, it is a bit of a vanity project, but that money is really valuable to the industry and making a wine industry work anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. So
one of the things that goes on here in New Orleans, Jim, which I think you probably know, that there's a lot of, with the culinary tradition that we have here, so there are a lot of charities and programs and things like that coming up, actually happening somewhat simultaneously with South African Wine Week, is Boudin Bourbon and Beer, and that's an Emeril Lagasse Foundation. All that money goes to youth programs to, you know, get people into the culinary tradition and these sorts of things. And are we seeing programs like that in South Africa as far as people coming into the wine industry? And
absolutely. The Chenin Blanc we were tasting earlier, part of the profits from that go to the Pebbles Project, which is a huge educational and kind of health charity for children in the Western Cape. Indaba, which is one of the biggest brands here in the U.S., has a huge educational fund that's part of their mission with the brand. And on the ground is a lot of just individual, you know, donating wines to this event and that event. It's just definitely a big part of what the industry is doing.
Got it. Yeah. Cool. What are we enjoying here? We're tasting a nice red wine.
We're tasting something from one of the oldest properties in South Africa, established in 1685. This is Klein Constantia. So they are one of five properties that are part of the original Constantia property, which was the wine that made South Africa famous in the 1700s. So back then they were known for a sweet wine, and Klein Constantia actually makes a wonderful Vin de Constance that's one of the most highly rated wines in South Africa and is in that historical style. But this is their red blend.
Okay.
So it's a Bordeaux blend. Now, Constantia overall is a cooler area. It faces the False Bay, which if you've ever watched Shark Week, you've seen False Bay because that's where the breaching sharks live.
Okay.
But if you can imagine those winds that are sweeping across False Bay, which is all that cold water bringing cool air up into the vineyards, it means it's not a particularly hot area, even though South Africa generally we think of as fairly Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. So a lot of Constantia is known for Sauvignon Blanc, and in fact, that's Klein Constantia's bulk of their production is actually Sauvignon Blanc.
Okay.
But they also have some Bordeaux varieties and make a wonderful, I think, very elegant Bordeaux blend.
Yeah, and what are we seeing as far as the blend here, do we know?
I don't have my glasses on, but let's see, 60% Cabernet, 64.
Here we go.
Oh, wait, this isn't the Bordeaux blend.
We got some Shiraz going on in there. Okay.
Shiraz in here. Okay. So Cabernet, Shiraz, was that Merlot and Petit Verdot?
Malbec and Petit Verdot. So okay. Mostly Cab, 44% Cab, 29 Shiraz, 15 Malbec, and 12 Petit Verdot. So interesting. So that kind of makes sense because I'm getting some of that nice, really bright fruit coming from the Shiraz in there. Yeah. Some of these really nice bright cherry notes and things like that that are going on in the wine.
Yeah, they used to do bottle all these varietally, and then they decided I think 8 or 10 years ago that was kind of silly. It was very small quantities of each one, and then ultimately they tried doing a blend and found they made a better wine by just making a blend, and they have more diversity on their Sauvignon Blanc offering. So they have some single vineyard Sauvignon Blancs and things like that. So
I think this is something that we were talking about earlier, Jim. I think this is a really good example where we're seeing, you know, three grapes that you would associate with a Bordeaux blend, minus Merlot in this case, and no Cab Franc in this case, but kind of introducing then the Shiraz in there to create something that's truly South African.
Yeah.
And it you know, I'm not getting the earthiness that you would get in a typical Bordeaux. This is a nice, bold, fruit-forward red. This is just a really solid, you know, this is a good red meat wine.
Yep. And I think, I would think a little bit more flexible than that. I think it's got some good freshness and acidity to it.
Sure,
and
absolutely.
It's not too tannic where it has to have the meat. It has to have those fats to meet it. So, definitely a very classic red wine style.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think you could do it because you mentioned with the acidity going on and some of the different flavors going on there. I mean, you could, you know, and I keep fixating on the meat thing because I'm a carnivore, but like, you know, even a bit of a spicy rub on a pork loin barbecue, pork loin, it's got enough oomph to stand up to that and some acidity to stand up to a little bit of spice. So like you said, a pretty flexible wine there, but definitely, you know, richer, bolder foods, I think is what we're going to want with this guy. So let's talk a little bit, Jim, just in sort of some broad strokes before we close things out. We do have, it's not a huge wine region as far as square kilometers goes, as you mentioned, but it's still sizable. And we do see a huge variation of terroir in South Africa. And I think that's something that people need to understand as well.
Yeah. I mean, like I say, it isn't huge, but it is the 8th largest producer in the world. So, you know, you just have to remember that the huge regions are Italy, Spain, and France, and then it drops off a bit after that.
Right.
Because the way the landscape is carved up. You have a set of mountains that runs north-south to Stellenbosch and then runs east-west from there. Whether you're on a north-facing slope or a south-facing slope, whether you're facing into the wind off the ocean or you're not getting that wind, can make really dramatic differences in the growing conditions, even just a few hundred, you know, yards from one place to another. You know, there are producers that have Riesling and Cabernet growing within 300 meters of each other precisely because one vineyard south-facing and getting all that wind. And remember, south-facing in the southern hemisphere means less sunlight because you're away from the equator.
Right.
And then the north-facing gets a lot more heat. So it all depends. So
yeah. So are we seeing then, too, because you mentioned this when we were talking about Chenin specifically a couple segments ago, that we're not you're not seeing, it's 18% of what's grown in South Africa, not seeing so much new plantings of Chenin because people have basically figured out where Chenin does well and it's already there.
Yeah.
Are we seeing people start to continue to establish new regions? I think we're talking, you know, mostly so people can picture, you know, most of this is in the southern and in southwestern portion of the country is where most of the wine growing.
Yeah, we're basically talking about the Western Cape, which is the province in the southwestern corner of South Africa. There are some regions that are being either explored or somewhat rediscovered. Lately, the ones that's been surprising me is isolated examples, but stretching further east, but always close to the water where they're getting that ocean influence. So, for example, yesterday I had a wine that was from Montagu, which is a region I really didn't know much about before that. And then there's hopefully today we'll have a wine from Oberlangklof, which is really quite out there in the Eastern Cape. It's actually, in this case, one of our golfer wines made by Retief Goossen. So,
So, and is that more a function just because the wine industry and things like that haven't been established out there, or is it more challenging on the eastern side to find good terroir?
Well, certainly. I mean, I'm talking about a difference of maximum a couple hundred kilometers.
Once you get to just moving east slightly.
Once you get to the Eastern Cape proper, it's it's much more tropical. You have to remember that that Mediterranean climate really is just that southwestern corner, okay. And it's because the South Atlantic is turning in a counterclockwise fashion. So it's bringing cold water and cold air basically up from Antarctica. Once you get to the Durban side, to the east coast, eastern side of South Africa, the currents are coming down the down from India. So they're bringing warm air.
Warm
and
water.
So
yeah.
Like when you look at if you're growing fruit in the Western Cape, you're growing apples or apricots or pears and things like that. If you're growing fruit in the Eastern Cape, you're growing bananas and mangoes.
Right.
It's that different.
Got it. Very, very interesting. Well, cool, Jim. So we let's remind people once again, just South African Wine Week coming up November 7th through the 13th.
Yep.
And website and hashtag.
Website is sawineweeknola.com. And the hashtag is the same thing without the NOLA, just so you don't have to type so much with your thumbs.
There you go.
SA Wine Week.
Perfect. Jim, thanks for being here. And I know you need to get set up because we got a industry wine tasting coming up. We're going to check out more of these wines. I'll be sure to report on that a little bit later. Thanks, Jim. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Thanks. Friends, we're going to take a brief musical interlude here, and I'll be back with my parting shot. Come on. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for tuning in to the NOLA Drink Show or podcasting with the NOLA Drink Show, however you're listening to the NOLA Drink Show. I really appreciate that this week and each and every week as you do. Thank you very much for being such great supporters of the show, and I hope you continue to enjoy it. Speaking of which, we've got a really good show coming up for you next week. I'm really excited about it. We're going to be chatting with three luminary chefs from New Orleans. Actually, two are from New Orleans and one is from Cajun country, and that would be Isaac Toops, who operates Toops Meadery and Toops South, and the two guys from New Orleans, two very famous and noted chefs, one Frank Brightson of Brightson's, operates a fantastic restaurant uptown that's been around since the mid-80s, a true mentor in the industry, and also Philip Lopez, who is the executive chef of the famed French Quarter restaurant Galatoire's. We talk with those three guys about Southern cooking, traditions in Southern cooking, some approaches, a lot about what they're up to, what they look forward to moving forward, many other great bits and tidbits of conversation. And importantly, we also talk about an event and organization that they are very passionate about and participate in. It's called, the event specifically is called Boudin Bourbon and Beer, and that is put on by the Emeril Lagasse Foundation, benefiting children's charities. Lots of funds are raised, friends, at this terrific event. It's coming up on November 9th here in New Orleans at Champion Square right by the Superdome. And a lot of these programs that they fund through the Lagasse Foundation, and their primary fundraising is through this event and a couple other things they do. It goes to give children, and especially at-risk kids or underserved kids, opportunities to make something of themselves, pursue a career, all kinds of things like that. And of course, as one might imagine, since we're talking about chefs and culinary and Emeril Lagasse, a lot of that is creating opportunities and creating pathways for these kids to get involved in the culinary world, but it's not limited to that. So anyway, great show next week. Be sure to tune in. Check that out. We tape that at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Always a favorite place of mine to hang out. Friends, this is the parting shot here on this week's show. Lots of times questions come up about integrity in the wine world. Now, I think sometimes in some issues, people put too much of an emphasis on certain things that really don't make that much of a difference, right? Like you think that estate makes so much of a difference, and estate wine. Well, really, you know, it can matter. If you do the farming really well, and estate means that you're growing the grapes on the property and the whole thing's going on the property, right? Growing the grapes there, all the way through the winemaking until those grapes end up as wine in a bottle. But, you know, working with independent growers, for example, where you source grapes from a farmer who knows what they're doing, probably does it in most instances better than what you would be able to do. Nothing wrong with that. As a matter of fact, lots of times the results, frankly, especially in New World wines, can be better. There's also concerns about outsourcing parts of the winemaking process, and I think people also think this is somehow lacking in integrity. Frankly, winemaking is expensive. If you're a young winemaker, young winery owner, having all of your own equipment, having all the space and all that stuff needed to actually make wine can be cost prohibitive and a significant barrier to getting involved. So lots of times people take advantage of using what's called custom crush, where a facility does a lot of the heavy lifting, if you will, but this is done with the fruit that you own, that you get to them and they make it according to your spec. And then maybe you take it over and you finish it off in your own cellar with your own barreling program and so on and so forth. Nothing wrong with that. A lot of people also operate out of co-ops, allowing multiple wineries and winemakers to pool their resources, if you will, to share equipment and space to make wine. So I think a lot of people fuss about this stuff when this really doesn't matter, and this does not indicate, in my book, any sort of lack of integrity in the world of wine. Now, on the other hand, there are lots of problems with issues of integrity in the world of wine. Counterfeit wines are a big problem in the world today. We've heard stories, and it's all over the place. I'm not just singling out China, but some of the famous stories of a lot of counterfeit Bordeaux being sold, or stuff, you know, being touted as being Bordeaux, but counterfeit wines being sold in China, a big problem in recent years. And again, it happens everywhere. Another example that was out in the news a couple years ago, 3 years ago, where tanker trucks of bulk wine from Spain, you know, a little bit cheaper to make wine in Spain than in most parts of France, were coming over the border into France, ending up in bottles, and of course, not being acknowledged as the source for the fruit in the wine. Okay, those things are problems, right? But here's another one that's a problem, and one that I've actually not heard before, ever happening before. And I'm sure it does. I've heard about problems happening with wine competitions. That's a story for another time. But in this case, the Court of Master Sommeliers, which some of you may know of this, but this is the certification and education organization, one of them anyway, on the planet that certifies folks who are sommeliers. Well, this broke a couple weeks ago. There was a cheating scandal that really rocked the somm world, if you will. I hate to use these words, but and I'll get to more of this in a second, but basically some of the test results from the blind tasting portion of the Master Sommelier level test, and I'll get to that in a second too. There was a leak, and some number of people taking the test were given the wines in advance. So what the organization did is they invalidated the tasting result portion of the test for everyone who sat at this test. Now, this test took place early September in St. Louis. Quartermaster Sommeliers was an organization that was founded in the United Kingdom in 1987, started operating in the United States in 1997, generally a well-respected organization. There are four levels of sommelier. The fourth level, as you might imagine, which is the Master Sommelier level, is by far the hardest one to achieve. In fact, there are only 273 Master Somms in the world today. This particular test that was given in St. Louis, I believe it was September 9th, something along those lines, was actually sat by 141 people, with 23 actually passing. And you might go, wow, man, that's really tough. Only 23 people out of 141 passed. Actually, that's a pretty damn high percentage. Lots of times it's just a handful and sat by a similar number of people. So this was actually a banner year for the number of people that actually passed. Now, we're going to get to the cheating part. You might go, oh, because everybody had the results, right? Or a bunch of these people had the results. Not necessarily the case, and there's not a lot of evidence to prove that. But I digress. When people take the Master Somm test, okay, there's parts that they have to do, different things that they have to do. One of them is a blind tasting portion of the test. You are given six wines that you actually have to test, and I'll get to what you have to do to identify those in just a second and what is required. But what happened was, as I mentioned, that some of the wines, or the wine list itself, was leaked by another Master Somm who had already passed his test and was proctoring the tasting portion. Now, let me emphasize some of this. To prepare for this test for people who take this test, it's typical for people to be tasting wines in a format like this, as I just described, on a daily basis for many years. One guy that they're talking to, who's head of a Somm Guild, a website, said, he took it for 6 years before he passed, and took it on multiple occasions. He said, typically the people that pass can describe and identify five or six of the wines out of the six you're given correctly, but there are also other factors involved in scoring. You're supposed to provide tasting notes and observations, how the wine is made, so on and so forth, not just identifying what the wine is by the varietal, who's the maker, who's the region, and what's the vintage. That's what you're asked to do, blind tasting six wines. Now, they don't throw you a lot of curveballs. They really can't. These are kind of iconic wines pulled from places that are, you know, notable out there. But still, it's really difficult. I've done a lot of blind tasting in my life, and to be able to nail five or six wines blindly and get all of that information right or close to right is really, really, really hard. Most people study for years, as I mentioned. It's an invite-only exam, friends. You don't just get to sign up. You have to be invited. You have to have achieved all kinds of things, including your level three, which is not easy to pass. And this organization has to see you as a bright spot in the world of wine and invite you to sit. A lot of these people who are getting ready for the test form groups and quiz one another on arcane facts about wine. They spend thousands of dollars buying bottles to taste. There's thousands that you have to spend on exam fees. You typically have to go travel for this, so there's airplane flights and hotel rooms.
Many people try and work with mentors, probably some of whom are paid. Many people never pass, no matter how many times they take it. If you're interested, there's a movie. It's a documentary called SOMM, S-O-M-M, that came out in 2012 or so. It was on Netflix. I think you can find it if you go poking around for it. It's an interesting film. So it's a really hard test to pass. And there's another little thing here, too, that those who pass it's so difficult that those who pass the test and pass it on the first try are awarded what is known as the Krug Cup. And if you get the Krug Cup, you are treated like a celebrity, like a rock star in the world of wine. People invite you to tastings. You have rich people who invite you to taste all kinds of rare bottles that you would never have the chance to taste because there's so much prestige with that. There are only 14 Krug Cup winners in the world right now out of those 273 Master SOMMs that I just mentioned. A guy that passed the test or presumably passed the test, Greg Van Wagner, who is the head sommelier at Jimmy's in Aspen, Colorado, was the 15th person to be given the Krug Cup, and he was one of the guys who just had that the whole thing stripped away from him, including the Krug Cup. He's the first winner in 6 years. He, like everyone else, now has to retake the tasting portion of the test and try and pass. And just because you passed once, I think you're gathering where I'm going with this, just because you passed once, and then if you have to take it again, it's not going to be easy. You can't just say, oh, I passed it once, I can pass it again. Hell no, it's really hard. A lot of these people that did pass will probably not pass the second time. One Master SOMM who is involved with the organization indicated that collectively for this group, it probably represents, of the 23 that passed, about 100 years of collective effort to actually study and prepare to get by this test. Nobody really knows how many cheated. At least one, obviously. There's some suspect out there. I read in one place, this is pretty much hearsay, that might have been two. Probably somebody confessed to having had cheated and getting the test results. The master sommelier who released the wines in advance, we don't know who that person is to this point. They have apparently been stripped of all their certifications and banned from the group, rightfully so. So the person has been identified. We just don't know publicly who it is. What happened on October 9th then is as this came out, there's more out there if you want to read. It was an attorney got in touch with the Court of Master Sommeliers and let them know in some fashion that this occurred. So people on October 9th were given a personal phone call, the ones that passed one by one, and said, you know, we're basically invalidating the tasting portion results of this. Devin Broglie, who's a Master SOMM and chairman of the board of the Court of Master Sommeliers, said, quote, maintaining the integrity of the examination process must be our highest priority, lest we risk diminishing the value of and the respect earned from becoming a master sommelier. He also continued, quote, we understand this decision is a shock to those who recently passed this exam, and we carefully consider the impact our decision has on our newly pinned masters and their careers. We are committed to developing an expedited process so that all eligible candidates can retake the tasting examination. Certainly words like devastated, shock, saddened, it affects people's careers, opportunities, raises. People would court you for jobs, not only having probably flying you in to their rich person's cellar and tasting you on a 61 Latour. So a lot of repercussions for this. Now, we're talking about integrity in the wine world, and everything that this guy said probably kind of have to go along with. It's a tough situation for everybody involved. Now, I will say this in trying to regain some amount of integrity here. On October 10th, the day after they made those phone calls, the court announced how it would retest those 23 people. They're going to refund the $995 fee that each person has to pay for the test. Yeah, it's a lot of money, right? They will waive the fee for the retest. And third, they will offer, quote, appropriate travel cost assistance, end quote, to people to make that test. They will have the option of taking it again this year, and I'm not sure where it's being offered, or in the spring of 2019. Again, not sure where that one's being offered either. So trying to regain a little bit of integrity there, and I wish every one of those folks good luck. I hope they all pass, all the ones that didn't cheat. There you go. And I hope they find out who those people are as well. But everyone who legitimately took the test and passed, I wish them the best of luck, and I hope they succeed. Friends, that's our parting shot. Hope to be with you next week. Here's to you. I'll be saying, as we try to bend your